Ladies and gentlemen, colleagues and friends, thanks for coming. I think we'd like to kick off this session, and I'm very pleased about the number of people who have come here. I'm very pleased that we have a very, very distinguished panel tonight to discuss, to present and discuss with you. I'd say a few words for the framework, about the framework of this session, this evening session. As you have seen, we have ordered some food for you because this is late in the day. We have a two-hour session, which gives us plenty of time for presentations and, most importantly, discussions, so you can actually ask your questions, make your points to the panelists, engage with the panelists. So we want to make sure that you have enough energy and building up energy until 8 when we will close. We hope that you will engage with us in a very lively debate and discussion. With no further words, I would like to kick off the session, and of course I'm extremely pleased to have to my left Stephen Lewis, the Special Envoy for AIDS in Africa and Undersecretary General of the United Nations. It is a great pleasure and honor to have him here as a true friend of the Global Fund, but of course, most importantly, as a relentless partner in the fight against the HIV and AIDS with a focus on Africa. And I don't think I need any further introductions. He's a hero, and he will address us in a short statement. Thank you, Stephen.
Let me briefly embarrass the chair for a moment by commenting on the remarkable gender equality of the panel. It normally takes 10 men, even vaguely, to approximate Kate Henkins, and we're apparently determined to demonstrate that. This is a gentle message to the Global Fund. I am neither a cheerleader nor a groupie, and anyway, Richard Feetcham doesn't want 68-year-old groupies. But I do feel, if I may say, in what will be a discursive and general range of observations, if I may say, the Global Fund, in my experience, has done and is doing a remarkable job. And I share with President Clinton the view that history has very few examples. I cannot think of another where a very major international financial facility has been put in place in such a short time and rendered so much contribution to humankind. It is really quite remarkable. There are, of course, detractors, and the Global Fund itself would be the first to admit that there are problems, sometimes on the ground, sometimes in the delivery of funds, sometimes in the support for different components or sectors. But overall, in a brief period of time, to get out billions of dollars and make such a change in the human condition, and to do it in a way where fully 75% of the activity and the disbursements, as is shown in the new results report, can be defensively argued as working effectively, that's really astonishing. I've been working for multilateral organizations for more than 20 years now, and I have a lot of time for the Global Fund. I've been a critic. I've exchanged occasional sardonic, acid, and even abusive words with Global Fund employees when I lost my normal rationality. But on balance, I have nothing but regard for them. And if the Global Fund, using the proposals that come from country level through the country coordinating mechanisms, if the Global Fund can continue to show the necessary flexibility, that's really what is, I think, at the center of things, around health systems, around money for capacity, around money for orphans. If we can understand that money is required for food in order to have a nutritious component of food available for those who are on antiretroviral treatment, the World Food Program today issued a fascinating study in some 18 countries showing that $1.1 billion between 2006 and 2008 was all that was necessary to provide the food supplements to over 6 million people on treatment and or who were living with the virus. And frankly, if the Global Fund can be a vehicle to provide funding of that dimension, it will also have demonstrated an exemplary position. Similarly, everything from school fees to payment for home-based care workers and women who are looking after orphans, generally compensation for the voluntary sector, which isn't voluntary, of course, it's conscripted and unacknowledged and unpaid, and we all know that, and it's always women. But if the Global Fund can respond to requests of proposals from country level to deal with that whole panoply of interventions and continue to show the flexibility as the various rounds of proposals are offered, then it will, in my mind, be one of those historical entities which actually does a good job from beginning to end. My remarks about reaching universal access by 2010 are fairly simple. They may not be entirely orthodox, but I want to give vent to them. I think we're on the eve of a desperate international financial crunch. I think everyone was misled by the constant repetitive mantra that we had gone from $300 million or so at the end of the 90s to $8.3 billion in 2005. And what seemed to be an appreciable and astronomic increase in money has led everyone to feel that somehow we're on course. And that $8.3 billion was identified as meeting the necessary resources in the UN Declaration of Commitment in 2001. Well, A, that's not right, but B, it's not relevant. We know from all of the work that was done that we need at least $15 billion in 2006, $18 billion in 2007, $22 billion in 2008. Any straight line projection and estimate of numbers will show you that it will rise to $30 billion by 2010, and the money is not there. We are billions short, billions upon billions short. And the sanguine response about money seems to me to be entirely misplaced. We are facing a real crunch down the road, and the people who know it are the governments who are struggling. The African governments talk to me, at any rate, constantly about financial sustainability. That's the phrase. They are desperately worried that the money that is required will not be available. And having said that, by way of prognosis, let me provide a diagnosis of the present circumstance. I'd like to point out, respectfully but unequivocally, that the promises made by the G8 at Gleneagles in July of last year are unraveling, all of them. The amount of money that was promised for aid will not be reached by 2010. Even Gordon Brown and Tony Blair are now admitting that publicly. The proposal to relieve a great many countries in the low-income and moderate-income area of their debt, multilateral or bilateral, is moving so incrementally as barely to be discernible. And we know that on trade, the entire Doha round has collapsed, with grievous consequences for African economies. The G8 is in the process of doing what the G8 always does to Africa, which is to betray Africa the moment the commitments are made. In terms of reaching universal access by 2010, the diminution in funding is really serious, and people should be alarmed about the way in which this shortfall is developing. Now, I have already expressed my devotion for the fund, but I want to say that when Richard Feetchum says publicly that they may be up to $500 million short in 2006, and at the moment over $1 billion short in 2007, that causes tremors of alarm to infect my molecular structure. And I want to say to Richard that although we may get that money over the next number of months, and I know how conscientiously, determinedly, and tenaciously he goes after it, it's crazy that we're in August of 2006 and we still don't have a guarantee of the minimum amount that we feel we will need in order to respond to the proposals that the Global Fund thinks it will receive. Good God, If the G8 countries are serious about fighting the pandemic, why are we struggling over a few $100 million more than halfway through the year to which that money applies? You cannot build a reservoir of financing to respond to the pandemic with such a kind of indifferent and lethargic and dilatory response. It means you're not serious. And then I want you to think about PEPFAR for a moment, the presidential initiative. No one has yet announced that it's going to be extended beyond 2008. You know, and I know, because we have to believe it, that the announcement of its extension will come at some point, presumably on the eve of the next presidential election. But suppose they announce it at a level of $3 billion a year again, which I would predict is most likely. Given the costs of conflicts around the world, they will probably announce it at a level of $3 billion a year again. Now, $3 billion in 2003 represented a very considerable percentage of the cost to deal with the pandemic. But if in 2008, when $22 billion a year is required and $3 billion a year is announced, that is a trifling percentage of the required amount from the largest potential benefactor in the world. We are in a financial crunch. It is looming. It is serious. And people are being too casual about the implications, having been hypnotized by this ascent from 300 million to 8.3 billion. And I beg you not to be. Now, everyone then, I'm going to take my seat in just a moment. I'm in a very Castro-like phase at the moment because I'm on my way out as envoy, and I really want to speak for 4 or 5 hours on every occasion, and it grieves me and wounds me deeply that I am contained to this fatuous 10 minutes or so. But in any event, everyone is sustained excitedly at the prospect of the $500 million from Bill Gates. It's a tremendous contribution. 200 million of it will probably come in this year, 100 million a year thereafter until the money runs out. It's a great contribution. Doesn't begin to be adequate for the job. We're still waiting, begging, praying celestially for the private sector to make the kinds of contributions that they should be making. I see Brian Brink, the vice president of Anglo-American, in the audience, who devotedly, methodically canvasses his corporate brethren, as yet with an almost cosmic futility. One day they may come through, but they haven't come through yet, so we don't have money from the corporate sector either to make up the shortfall. There are all of these inventive initiatives. There's the Red Campaign by Bono. There's the International Financial Facility, which Gordon Brown has pursued. There's the extra tax on airline tickets from France and now a number of other countries. These are all useful and worthy fundraising initiatives, much of which money will go to the Global Fund. It isn't enough. Nothing can compensate for the contributions of governments. And this lack of political leadership is really causing pain. Now we have Gates and Clinton and Bono and Geldof and Oprah and Angelina and Madonna and Richard Gere. We are drowning in celebrity leadership to compensate for the absence of political leadership. And I'm crazy about all of them, and I rub shoulders with as many of them as I can in the hope that legitimacy will be conferred upon me. But I want to tell you, if we are serious about universal access by 2010, if we are serious about subduing the worst scourge ever to plague humankind, if we're serious on continents like Africa about rescuing the women of Africa from a destination fraught with death, then something has to be done about the financial shortfall which is looming And it means that all of you, advocates, activists, however you are collectively engaged, in the most indefatigable fashion, you have to hammer away relentlessly at the portals of power until they succumb. There's a lot at stake. Millions of lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen, for that incredible kickoff. It's now my great pleasure to also invite Richard Feacham to the podium to say a few words. Richard has left a very comfortable position in San Francisco more than 4 years ago to become the founding director of the Global Fund, to take up an incredible challenge, which was certainly also empowered, including through some of his staff, like myself, so I won't go into much further detail there. But I do know that the rewards of seeing an organization grow because of our partners being able to put actually the resources that have been given to us to good use has kept him going with incredible energy and helping us to be where you are now. Richard.
Well, thank you, Bernard, and good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming. And I have to start by really thanking, as you all have, by your applause and the fact you all stood up, thanking Stephen for what he's been doing for the last several years and what he does every day and every minute and most of his nights and most of his evenings as well. He is our voice and he is our conscience, and we have no better conscience and we have no better voice than Stephen Lewis. And I want to really, really thank him for everything he has done to drive us to where we are and to point out yet again that we're not yet in the right place and we've got a long way to go. Thank you, Stephen. And I also want to make a point that we sometimes lose, but I think it's incredibly important, and pay tribute to my fellow panelists who are the implementers, who are the people on the front line actually delivering complex and difficult projects in complex and difficult circumstances. And I'm sorry they're all of the male persuasion. There are lots of other persuasions in the audience, and I pay tribute to the women on the front line as well. But I want to thank Alexei and Paul and Tedros and Eric and Dr. Towisap for the work that they do, because they and many in this audience who are the implementers on the front line, they and you have the difficult job of doing the work and scaling up the programs in sometimes extremely challenging and difficult circumstances. The Global Fund's job may be essential, but it's the easy part. Raising large amounts of money and making it available to you, to 132 countries, to 400 programs in an accountable and transparent and flexible and easy to use kind of a way. That has been a challenge. As Stephen said, we've come quite a long way in a short period of time, but ours is not the hard task. The hard task is the implementation, and I want to pay tribute to that. But I have to concentrate my remarks this evening on the finance. The finance, as Stephen has eloquently said, is an essential part of finding the solution. And yes, indeed, we've come quite a long way in the last few years. The Global Fund now has assets of $9.5 billion, of which $6 billion has been paid into its bank account. And that's better than 5 years ago when the figure was zero. So we need to be pleased about that. And we need to express our thanks to those who have provided that money. But it's nothing like enough. It's nothing close to enough. And the financing gap remains very large. As Stephen has reminded us, to have a fully funded round six, we need an additional $500 million that today we don't have. I think we're going to get it, but we're going to get it by constant effort and cajoling and arm twisting and bullying, not only us, but our many advocate friends in this room who do it more effectively than we can. And we will get there. But how distracting and how inappropriate that we have to spend our time doing this. and not helping Tedros do what he has to do on the front line in Ethiopia, or helping Paul and his colleagues doing what they have to do on the front line in the several countries where he is working, or helping Alexei in Russia. And how inappropriate that we're still in this year-to-year, hand-to-mouth financing situation for the Global Fund. Let's remember that it was the G8 in Gleneagles, and it was the G8 again in St. Petersburg, who set the universal access target. We encouraged them. We welcomed it. But they set the target. They should own the target. It's their target. And without a fully financed global fund, universal access is absolutely pie in the sky. There is no prospect of universal access or anything close to universal access without a fully financed global fund. And we don't have enough money, and it's not sustainable and predictable. It's not long-term enough. And we have to invest so much effort that should be spent on ensuring that the money is working hard in the 132 countries and delivering the prevention and the treatment. That's what our time and energy should be focused on, but instead so much time and energy is focused on raising that money and keeping the ship afloat. The sustainability and predictability has really come into the agenda in the last 6 months alongside the adequacy. We need enough money. We've always told ourselves that. We've always fought for that. But the new dimension to the argument is not just enough, but sustainable and predictable. And everyone in this room knows this story very well. If the money stops, the drugs stop, the treatment stops, and people die rather quickly. If the money fluctuates, the drugs fluctuate, and resistance in the virus to the drugs is accelerated, which would be a massive catastrophe on a global scale. So the sustainability and predictability of the income to the Global Fund, in order that the investments in the 132 countries can also be sustainable and predictable and reliable. And countries can know, if I deliver the performance, the money will continue to flow. Not if I deliver the performance, the money may continue to flow, depending how successful Richard and Paul Zeitz and others are in raising the income. That's not good enough. There has got to be a commitment to the sustainable and predictable financing. It's on the agenda, but we haven't had the delivery against that agenda. I was very struck by the fact that a few weeks ago, Gordon Brown and Hillary Benn and Tony Blair made a 10-year commitment to finance education programs in the developing world. We've never had a 10-year commitment in the field of development to do anything. That's an absolutely historic and novel commitment, a 10-year commitment of $15 billion for education. We need 10-year commitments for HIV/AIDS, and they need to be much larger. And I think the UK government, to their great credit, have opened that door for us. They've opened the possibility, which only a year or two ago would have been a pipe dream, of a 10-year commitment. We now have one. We can build on it. If we have a 10-year commitment for education, why not a 10-year commitment for HIV/AIDS? And if we have a 10-year commitment from the United Kingdom, why not a 10-year commitment from every other G7 nation? What's so hard about that? Let's fight for that. It is the new frontier, and it's absolutely essential for universal access. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. We're now going to our second part, or the first main part of the program, which will include six short presentations. But for those who have come later, please pick up your lunch bags so you don't need to leave because of hypoglycemia. And we will, after the presentations, come to a panel discussion where we want you to very actively participate. So note down your questions so we can kick off right after we finish with the presentations to make the best use of the time and of the incredible experience and skills that we have around the table and in the room today. I will introduce my distinguished colleagues and speakers as they come up to the podium to deliver the presentations. the first presentations of Daniel Lobier. He is a deputy director of the Department for Performance Evaluation Policy and will present in a very short presentation, a concise presentation, the latest results of the Global Fund before we then go to the presentations from individual countries, from our implementing partners, which of course are the most important part of today's session. Daniel, please.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to present the latest results of the Global Fund. It struck me as somewhat ironic following Steve's and Richard's mainly bad news on the finance that we actually have some quite good news when we look towards the results and the results of the work of countries. And that's very much what I want to present today. I want to present the progress, but also, as with the Global Fund, many of the challenges, particularly under the title of moving to investing in universal access and investing in impact. First of all, I very much encourage you to look at our yellow book we've just published on the results, which really gives much more the picture and the texture of the work of countries in which receive financing from the Global Fund. But when we look at the most recent results, mid-2006 for the Global Fund, the first message is we're in the stage of very rapid scaling up of results, roughly doubling every year when we look at them. Secondly, when we look at the performance of our grants, we have problems in performance in some countries, but overall 75% of the grants are performing against their targets and can make the money work, and this really is very encouraging. Thirdly, to sustain this, it's important that we continue our investment in health systems, in systems, and the 50% of our resources that go into sustaining delivery through systems. And at present, performance due to this, performance of our grants is no worse in poorer countries or in countries with poor health systems. And that dual investment is very important as we sustain our results. And then the final message in investing in impact is it requires an exceptional effort from the fund, from our partners, and also from financing. And I will talk a little bit to the challenges of that at the end. First of all, what do we measure in the Global Fund? This is our evaluation pyramid, and we look at four levels. At the bottom, our own operations, how quick we are at dispersing. Secondly, and most importantly at this stage, is the grant performance, the performance of our countries. Thirdly, we look at how well we work with country and partner systems in countries. It is through that that our financing is going to achieve impact. And at the very top, the average age of our grants is still young, 22 months, but the pyramid works towards impact. It's a pyramid because the Global Fund contribution is greatest at the bottom as we go towards impact. It's the collective effort, particularly of countries, but also of our partners. First of all, it's important that we track the speed of our disbursements and do we disperse money on time. From 3 years ago where we had no grants, we've now moved to a position of global scope, financing over 300 grants in 127 countries by mid-2006. Grants signed are $4 billion and we've disbursed $2.26 billion in this period. If you compare the amount of time elapsed in our grants for the dispersal, we're dispersing about 93% on time. So despite individual countries, overall money is getting to countries rapidly. 77% of these funds have been dispersed by the end user in our grants, by our principal recipients or our sub-recipients. So countries now are receiving the finance and are using it. We disperse money to achieve results through performance-based funding. And this gives you the latest results to June 2006 of the work of our grants and programs in countries. It shows we've moved from a position in the last 3 years, which is quite extraordinary, of delivering tens of thousands now to millions of services across the three diseases. Our programs have put 544,000 people on ARV treatment, provide TB treatment to 1.4 million people, and have distributed 11.3 million bed nets to protect families from malaria. The rate of growth is also extraordinary with a stage of rapid scaling, which certainly brings together major challenges the results are doubling roughly 2 to 3 times every year. While we are a major contribution to global results, around a third of ARV results, we're still a long way off international targets. And this is one of the challenges, is to scale up our results and scale up the financing to reach international targets. The overall Global Fund results, as Richard stated very eloquently, is the result of the work of partners and the work of people in countries doing the hard work. And it's very important that our funding in countries is performing. So we look through performance-based funding at the performance of our grants in countries. Here we grade them, and we grade them very explicitly, so it's available to countries and to partners, from A-rated grants, B1, B2, and C. We can see that around 21% of the grants are B2. They have problems but have demonstrated potential, and another 4% have unacceptable performance. So there are issues of performance in around 25% of our grants. But at the same time, 75% of countries can make the funding work, can use the funding to achieve the results that they have stated. Equally important is that our funding follows that performance. So it's continually flowing where we can best get people, reach people with services, and can achieve these results. So despite the variation in performance, overall, and this is across the three diseases and across treatment, prevention, care, 88% of the high-level targets and grants, when you put the low and the high-performing grants together, have been achieved. And in the HIV ones, which are at the top, we have relatively good performance. Slightly lower in the early stages of grants in malaria due to procurement, though these can rapidly catch up, as we will hear from the Ethiopian minister. But equally important is the learning process of performance-based funding. We make the results as transparently as possible so that countries can learn from implementation. And here is a quote from the Minister of Health from Ethiopia around the performance-based funding system in his country. "What made the difference is that you gave us a clear warning that we were in the red zone, that we could lose our money if we didn't deliver results. We looked at it, we could focus, and we both saw the problem. And that was the adjustment we made to get the results. Performance-based funding helped us think through implementation." We also need to learn some of the lessons from performance corporately, and you'll see a lot of the description in the results report. Overall, when we look at our grants, civil society is not just important in governance, but has shown itself to be a very strong implementer. Secondly, when we compare the diseases, TB is performing very strongly, and there may well be some lessons for HIV from TB grants. They certainly are well established with costed plans. They also have a comprehensive and defined package of technical assistance and a TB drug facility. And then finally, performance is no worse in poor countries or in sub-Saharan Africa. Though there are issues of performance we need to look at, there are fewer A-performing grants in sub-Saharan Africa. Therefore, alongside the poorest performing grants, we need strategies for technical assistance that can help the majority of grants who are B1 performing become excellently performing. And this is where we think we'll also get the highest returns. The great challenge going forward over the next two to five years is to invest in the health systems to sustain these results and into impact. And the report very much sets the stage, hopefully, for this discussion of the challenges of scaling up our results towards impact. 50% of our resources go towards building the health systems to deliver our services, and it's been very important, at least so far, that the performance of grants is no worse in poor countries or in countries with poor health systems. And it's very important we keep that balance in our investments as we go forward. We need to invest increasingly in HIV impact, driven evaluations, which are going to focus from service delivery to prevalence, mortality, and behaviors, and track our progress towards the MDGs. At the present, we contribute a third of global results around the major indicators, but there's still a long way off the global targets that have been set. However, in the report, it does show signs of collective impact in some countries, and we need to learn from these declines in prevalence, which have been shown in The Lancet and in our results work, and some early signs you'll hear of ARV treatments on mortality. Here is a quote. When I go to countries of some of the impacts we see around ARV treatment, these are still very localized. They're in particular regions, particular hospitals, but we need to see them as we scale up our resources. You go to the medical ward and half of the beds are not occupied before they were mushrooming. A manager came to me with Minister of Health and said, "You were bad for business. Our funeral business is going down." There was a time when every weekend we were burying 4 to 8 people. Now weeks go by without a funeral. These are in very, very limited areas, but they are showing the potential for impact of some of our interventions. Finally, the results are there to open the discussion on the challenges, and it wouldn't be a Global Fund report if there wasn't many challenges to those implementing programs and also to the Global Fund as we learn and we adapt as a funding instrument. Challenges there are for the Global Fund and to our financing instruments: keeping a focus on performance, improving the transparency of our information so that countries and partners can share the results of our grants and respond to them, improving CCMs, one that having parallel governance systems, improving the flexibility, and focusing grants over the next 2 to 5 years as we build towards impact. Also, challenges go certainly beyond the Global Fund, as these results do, to our partnership system. We need to improve the engagement and the functioning of the partnership system and jointly improve investment conditions for health. As Richard was saying, the confidence of investors to invest over the 10 years in health similar to education. And then finally, the major challenge to reach impact is going to be the exceptional effort which needs to start with sustainable finance to invest in impact. And it's really when the pistons are firing on all those three levels that we will be able to move from what hopeful results towards the questions of universal access and to impact that the panel is going to discuss today. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. It's now my pleasure to ask Paul Farmer to take the floor and give a short presentation. Paul Farmer is professor of the medical school in Harvard University and founding partner of the NGO Partners in Health. Paul has been a friend for a long time and is a truly remarkable person. And there's not that many persons that I know who, as young medical students, withstand the clutter of an elite university in the US and decide to move to the swamps of one of the poorest countries, to Haiti, to show against all existing opinions that it is possible to bring ARVs to people in the poorest communities. Paul is going to report today on his experience in Rwanda, where he's working with a national program in helping them to implement not only the Global Fund grant, but the broad range of activities that the government with this part is doing there. Thank you,
Bernard. Thank you all for being here. I'd like to apologize in advance. I have to leave before this is over, but my coworkers from Haiti and Rwanda are here today, and so in the discussion, if there are specific questions, they'll be able to answer them. I'd like to start by saying, I guess I'm the first implementer, right? I'm the first implementer number one to speak. And on the way in, I said to Richard, I thanked him, as I have before, and he said, "No, you shouldn't thank me. You guys are doing the hard work on the front lines." I could have added in response that I would rather work in Rwanda than in Geneva. It's true, I did not. But I have a particular gratitude to Richard, to Stephen Lewis, to Daniel, to Bernard, and others who are really working to create a policy environment in which the implementers, like me and like many of you in the room, can do our work. And I'd like to demystify a little bit about that process of implementation by looking back. As Daniel said, you know, 3 years ago, we didn't have any grants. And sometimes we talk about 4 years ago, but really, and others will be the chroniclers of the birth of the Global Fund. But I can tell you from my own experience, and I'm just using these images to remind me, that in the spring of 2002, the first CCM meeting in Haiti, and probably one of the first in the world, was held in central Haiti, in the middle of a squatter settlement. And if you're looking hard at the map, you can see where this was held in a village, which had been a squatter settlement, as I said, named Kanj. And it was a very unusual experience because, first of all, people from these different sectors of society, including the elite from Port-au-Prince, including many from the NGO world, there were lots of patients there. There were people from the Ministry of Health. They hadn't ever been together, certainly not in rural Haiti. So that in and of itself was a very interesting day. And it required a lot of effort in those first few months of 2002, in the middle of a very fractured society, as many of you know, to pull together a CCM and then a grant, which was one of the first grants approved by the Global Fund in the first round. And in the summer of 2002, with no experience of ever having succeeded in having money of this proportion, and this was about $2.3 million to Central Haiti that year, we heard that we would be approved for this scale-up effort. And that was really a remarkable moment, just really not that long ago, summer of 2002. Now, it took some time, of course, for the Global Fund to get these monies to the field. This was an unprecedented experiment, as several have argued in the course of the last few days. And but we had promised a town in Central Haiti, a town called Las Caobas, and you can look at the map, but some of you met a patient from Las Caobas today or yesterday, famous patient really because he's that image, the before and after that many of you have seen that we sent to the Global Fund when we said, look, Richard, here's what your money's doing. He's here. He may be here tonight, but he's certainly been here with me. And I think if he were telling this story in English, he might like the way I recall it, because we had made a promise to this town that we would go there and begin our scale-up in the summer of 2002. Now, we had decided that all the scale-up would occur in the public sector. And I say we, by the way. I should have added that although one of my colleagues from Russia is here today, we as Partners in Health, a group that had learned, I think, the hard way after 10, 15 years, that we really should be doing more to strengthen the public health sector. So we knew that the scale-up needed to occur in the dilapidated, really abandoned public health sector. So this town of Las Caobas, they were very disappointed, and so we said, well, we don't have the money yet. And we decided, and I don't know if Richard or others from the Global Fund know this story, but we actually took out a loan from a commercial bank in Boston. So great was our faith in the Global Fund that we took out a loan from a commercial bank in Boston. Now, I know Richard's interested in health economics just a wee bit, so I'm not so sure how that would pass muster among planners and health economists, but we took out a loan for $2 million, which was the amount of money that we knew we'd be getting from the Global Fund. And we went to the town of Las Caobas and did what we promised to do, which was to elaborate a plan with them about the rebuilding of the public health sector in that town of 55,000 people. And this was a process to be repeated again and again. Every red dot on this map is a Global Fund scale-up site. So this was number one, and probably one of the earliest ones in the world. And I just want to say again, to demystify, especially for those of you who are activists or who are younger than I, which is a very distinct majority, Stephen, you mentioned feeling old, but you know, look around. I'm older than most people here. But those of you who are thinking about going into this work, and I encourage you to do so, it's not a mystery how to do this implementation work. You have to fight for every little detail. So we had someone come from the Global Fund. I won't name him here. He is a brilliant fellow. But remember, no Global Fund grant had ever really been worked out in detail. And we struggled through every detail. For example, we said we need budget, of course, was a big issue. We need this much for HIV meds. That was actually not a struggle, which is amazing because in the years preceding 2002, August in 2002 this was, we had fought every month and every year for the ARVs, but we didn't have to fight. So then we kept on adding on other things. We said, well, we need the TB meds, and the unnamed emissary from the Global Fund said, this is not a TB grant. It's an AIDS grant, Paul. And I said, yeah, but half of our patients have tuberculosis. We have to integrate this. And then we said, and we also need money for women's health. And he said, Paul, this is not the Global Fund for Women's Health. And we said, well, you can't deliver prevention of mother-to-child services without women's health, and you certainly wouldn't want to, you know, give short shrift to all the services that we need for comprehensive women's health. And then we said, also, we need all the diagnostic and meds for STDs. And that was less of a struggle, I have to say. And we won all those struggles until we got to, we want tin for the roofs of our patients' houses. There we failed. And I'll return to that issue at the end because I want to talk about, very briefly, about food. But we worked this out. And again, I encourage you to be heartened, to be encouraged, those of you who are working on implementation. It wasn't easy. And it was a really collaborative process because, you know, we felt the Global Fund is ours. It's our creature. We have to fight for these details. And it's not our funder, although technically it is our funder, and the funder of our projects really in 7 countries, including Russia, and my colleague is here from Russia. But we always interacted with the fund as if it was our creature and we had some control over it and that it was a collaborative process. And that we have to continue. Now, what does this look like? Danielle just said hospitals are hospitals again. Can I say next slide, or is that imperious and inappropriate, as Stephen Lewis might say? So, abandoned places, and we built or rebuilt hospital after hospital, training centers. And of course, we had to raise other money in addition to the Global Fund money. The Global Fund money was not a fund for rebuilding shattered public health infrastructure. Shattered, by the way, as Stephen Lewis has reminded us many times, by very poorly thought out and indeed punitive policies from international financial institutions and others. So these public health systems took a long time to destroy, but we rebuilt them. And as you can see, I think, from these rather jolly-looking, clean buildings, all across the map of Central Haiti are now newly refurbished public health facilities, Ministry of Health facilities, that have been refurbished. It is true with money other than the Global Fund money often, but really by using the Global Fund as a means for promoting primary health care. It is vertical funding, it is an AIDS grant, but we said we are going to horizontalize this as much as we can and make sure that we use this to rebuild the public health sector. By the way, in the early years of the Global Fund, our only major partner at the time, we were told, well, you're not going to be able to scale up, this can only be done in this limited area, and we did scale up, and then we heard later that, well, you won't be able to do this in other countries, and so next slide, please. I don't know who's pushing the slides, but these slides are not from Haiti. They're from Rwanda. And it wasn't our second Global Fund experience. We had worked for the Global Fund in Peru, in Siberia, in Russia. But when we went to Rwanda, we were assigned to an abandoned hospital, abandoned since the genocide. And I think I've told some of you the story before. Actually, I don't know if Dr. Agnes Binagwaho is in the room, but she is the director of the Rwanda National AIDS Program, and some of you heard her plenary today. She's an amazing person. We went to a public hospital in northern Rwanda, and I looked around and I said, well, there's electricity here, and there's a doctor and a nurse, and there's an x-ray machine. Can't you come up with anything tougher than this? And the Minister of Health then sent us to this place as punishment. And Dr. Binagwaho said to him, you know, you should take the Partners in Health people and send them to the most rotten corner of the country, and they'll do fine. And I looked at her and said, is that a compliment, or am I? She said, yes, it's a compliment. Actually, my friends from that town, Ringwava, are here today. And Michael Rich, who is over there, can answer any questions and specifics. But we went there. This is a picture taken in March of 2005. And you can see the wards that we found, as you heard already, empty hospitals. And this is a problem all over Africa. They're either too full or too empty. And when they're too full, sometimes two to a bed, they will soon become empty unless we have the Global Fund and other funding instruments, making sure that patients who live in poverty are unable to seek care simply because they're poor. So we found an abandoned hospital. This is the before picture of the women's ward, and the next picture is an after of the women's ward. And I would add that that's also Dr. Innocent, the minister. Rwanda has a cabinet-level position on AIDS, which I think is an important thing for us to think about. And so we've benefited from a great deal of political will from the Rwandan authorities. And the other picture, which I hope will please my friend Sarah, who's here, director of pediatrics, is of a pediatric ward that was built out of an abandoned building. We don't know what its initial intention may have been. It was never completed, but for 10 years it lay empty, and who knows what it was used for during the genocide. But it is now a very vibrant, functioning pediatric hospital. Just one more slide, and then I'll close. The model I've already discussed is one of supporting community health workers. This is Joseph, who I've mentioned already, with his community health worker. Next and final slide. And I just want to return to not only our obligations to the Global Fund, but maybe what we could do with it. Our obligations to the Global Fund, I hope, are clearer as these speakers and these presentations go on. The Global Fund is not the global ATM. It is not a cash machine for us to walk up to and hope to extract large sums of money. It is, again, a collective responsibility, and I think Stephen has made this point very eloquently. I've heard him do this not just here, but in other countries as well. And we need to make sure that the Global Fund survives. There is no other precedent. There is no other institution that can compare to it. It is the world's best mechanism to make amends and to address a series of problems that clearly have solutions. You've heard some of you already that there are things we can do, we think, to make the Global Fund more responsive to the needs of our patients. For example, patients who are hungry, can we find ways to introduce food security? As we fought to add women's health to the Global Fund funding in 2002, now we may have other obligations to think about, again, food, primary school education, water, and even housing. However, if we press the Global Fund too much and are not able to do our job as citizens, as implementers, as policymakers, to make sure that it continues over the next many decades, at least, I think that we are going to be unable to find alternative funding mechanisms. In certain countries, perhaps, even in certain poor countries, but no other instrument exists that would allow us, again, to make amends. And when I say to make amends, I mean make amends really for history and all of the errors that we've made in the past, allowing some parts of the world to become so rich and other parts to languish in poverty and inequality. Thank you very much, and thank you, Global Fund.
Thank you, Paul. It is a challenge for each of the speakers to stay short because every one of them could entertain us with excitement for a whole evening with the stories they can tell. It is now my pleasure to invite the Honorable Minister of Health from Ethiopia to present the case of Ethiopia. And I think many of you have seen the famous yellow results report of the Global Fund. And the minister features there quite prominently, also with a quote, not only with the excellent results that he's been able to achieve in his country. And I think one of the remarkable features is that he actually took very positively the pushing and arm twisting that we did when we felt that maybe the results are not quite at the level that we had hoped. But he certainly was able to turn that around into one of the great successes. Honorable Minister of Health in Ethiopia, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Richard is actually my mentor in 1991 when I was doing my master's, and it's really a great privilege to work with him and sitting on his side. I agree with what Dr. Farmer said, but Global Fund should survive because in our press conference on Monday, actually, I tried to outline some of the really the some of the points or some of the important issues that distinguish Global Fund. One is it's country-owned. The second one is performance-based and makes countries accountable. And the third is the flexibility. And the fourth is, the funding is really can be reprogrammed to use to strengthen the health systems, as what Paul Farmer said. Then having said this, in Ethiopia, as you may know, we have around between a range of 800,000 and 1 million people living with HIV/AIDS. And we have been using all three pillars to really reach out as many people as possible with regard to treatment, care and support and prevention. And in April 2005, we had 900 on free treatment, but now it's fresh data. We have around 45,000 which have ever started, which is in 1 year and 3 months. And care and support, we're supporting more than 100,000. And prevention, we're trying to involve communities through an innovative idea health extension package through deploying new cadre of health extension workers. And this, I think, is encouraging for us, but it's not enough, and we have to really scale up. And to scale up, what we're saying is we need to really have high speed, big volume, and of course, not compromising the quality. So we have to really use speed, volume, and quality as our dashboard in order to ensure the universal access we're aspiring to achieve by 2010. And in order to do that, HIV/AIDS should be part of the overall development program of the country. So it's in the PASDEP, which is the Plan for Accelerated and Sustainable Development Program of the country. And based on that, we have developed the Health Sector Development Program for 5 years. And based on that, we have the HIV/AIDS Strategic Plan. So with regard to the health services, we'd like to achieve universal access by 2010. Primary health care actually by 2008, and universal access to all three pillars, the care and support, treatment, and prevention by 2010. So we have tried to align it, make it part of our development program or our development plan, because it's a threat to our development. And in order to speed up, we're using the continent model. We're starting from the grassroots, involving communities, doing social mobilization, and to do that, deploying thousands of health extension workers. And so far, we have reached more than one-third of the villages, and we have trained enough to cover one-third of the villages, which is out of the 15,000. And using social mobilization, that feeds, the VCT or counseling and testing. So many people, if we can do it through social mobilization, can come to the voluntary counseling and testing, which we are actually now changing it into counseling and testing and using lay counselors and using the opt-out model. And we can get through social mobilization more into the VCT actually. Having more in the VCT means then we can have more into the ART. So if we can do that, if we can really reinforce those, starting from the social mobilization grassroots, then to the VCT, then ART, we can actually achieve the targets and we can reach out as many people as possible. But when you use the continent model, starting from the grassroots, one of the challenges would be to satisfy the human resources needs. And to address that, as I said it earlier, we're training new cadres of health extension workers and deploying them. And the target was to train 30,000 by 2008, and we have so far trained and deployed 9,900. And by 2008, we will reach the target, which is actually on schedule, because we have already achieved one-third of the target. And then the other human resources issue is having trained, health officers that can, in order to accelerate ART services and to expand health centers and to really fulfill the nurse and health officer requirement for that category. And what we're using is, like the previous health extension workers, we're using the flooding strategy and to train as many as possible. We're training until 2010, for instance, 5,000 health officers which can cover the whole country and increase the access to ART services. But with regard to the human resources, one thing that we have to really underline is we need to really demystify the ART services. But because most of the time what many people believe is unless a doctor or a physician actually is involved, that there cannot be a working ART services, but which is really wrong. And what we're trying to do is to make it a nurse-centered program and to really decompress it or decentralize it to a health center level. So nurses can be used to initiate treatment and also to refill it. So what is important is we need to have use the existing asset to the maximum. And if we can make it nurse-centered, the issue is we can also achieve whatever targets we have and follow the principles that we have already outlined, the speed, volume, and quality. For instance, for the VCT, we're going to use lay counselors and we will train them by the thousands. So that way we can actually, as I said, follow the principle which I said, the speed, volume, and quality. Then the other issue is the sustainability, which should come with it. Okay, we're putting lots of things, but unless that's sustained, it can actually backfire. So one of the issues to sustainability is strengthening the health system, which as I have outlined in terms of human resources, in terms of equipment, and in terms of the infrastructure, it has to be strengthened. And we have to tap on resources, and we are installing AIDS fund, and communities are contributing on a monthly basis from their salary to install AIDS fund to cover if there is any shortage, or in the long term to cover in case there is, as what has been said, you know, the support may not, will not be forever, of course. And local production of ARVs is also identified as one sustainability issue. And with regard to care support involving people living with HIV on income generating activities is identified as sustainability issue. Having said this, I would like to say just a bit on harmonization. In order to really accelerate, one of the important challenges or the important issues that we have to address is we need to really avoid or address the duplication issues. So this is a continuation of the Paris Declaration, and not only for HIV/AIDS, but we're doing it for the health services in general, and we have signed a code of conduct with our partners. But one of the exemplary is the memorandum of understanding which was signed between Global Fund and PEPFAR. This was done in order to create synergy and to avoid any duplication of efforts. And this was signed in February 2007, in February 2006. And we have tried to use Global Fund to reinforce each other with PEPFAR so we can achieve more results. This was because of problems that we were facing in terms of duplication of efforts. And both PEPFAR and Global Fund, after signing this memorandum of understanding, we used the three principles and agreed to joint implementation of sites and targets and to align all efforts and to follow the national targets. And we have also identified specific areas that should be covered by Global Fund and specific areas that should be covered by PEPFAR. And PEPFAR is covering, for instance, the technical assistance, training, supportive supervision, and second line and pediatric drugs. And Global Fund is covering first line treatment and STI and opportunistic infection. And both are supporting renovations, lab reagents, condoms, and others. So this has actually created some synergy because it reinforces each other. For instance, for the health system strengthening, we're using Global Fund money to upgrade clinics to become health centers to develop ART, PMTCT, and VCT clinics. And we're using PEPFAR funds to equip the health centers. So we're trying to reinforce it. And in order to sustain it, we have a joint committee that follows actually the day-to-day implementation, or, you know, based on our plan. And we have started the PEPFAR 2007 plan, and we are in the process of creating even more harmony to get better results. So having said this, I would like to thank the PEPFAR support, and also I would like to thank Global Fund and the World Bank for the major support in terms of financing. And in the near future, we are also expecting the World Bank to join Global Fund and PEPFAR for the to actually complete the harmonization. And we will also encourage other partners to join harmonization, which can actually have a better impact in terms of getting results. So thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. It is now my pleasure to ask Eric Schoten to present on his experience for Malawi. He's the AIDS coordinator in Malawi. He's a Dutch national. He likes to sail. He doesn't have much time for that in his work. And he's very pleased about the fact that he, as a Dutch national, has actually been given the opportunity to work in Malawi, in a country, a very poor country in Africa, that with great level of energy and enthusiasm tries to overcome huge challenges, partly with support of the Global Fund. Eric, please.
Yes, thank you very much. As I said, working as HIV/AIDS coordinator in the Ministry of Health in Malawi, and I've been asked to speak a bit of the role of the Global Fund and the success of a concerted effort by different donor partners in scaling up of AIT in Malawi. As you already said, I'm Dutch. I'm working in the Ministry of Health in Malawi. I'm paid for by the US government, and I'm asked by DFID to give this proposal on Global Fund. So one example that the coordinated effort is possible. The main example, what I'll be speaking about, is the Human Resources Emergency Relief Plan that has been established a couple of years ago in Malawi. But also, today I will speak about some of the challenges for the Global Fund and the donors for scaling up towards universal access of treatment. I will be repeating what has been said, far more eloquent than I am able to. Shortly, Malawi, small country, 12 million inhabitants, impoverished, but with a large and major HIV epidemic. Almost a million people infected and 90,000 deaths annually. That's one person dying every 6 minutes, and with a severe human resource crisis. We're speaking about an absolute shortage of health staff in Malawi. On the basis of the establishment, and it has been an establishment made before HIV was a major crisis, there's over 50% shortage of main officials. Many districts have 1.5 or even less nurse per health facility, and 10 districts are even without a doctor at all. Another example to show the severe crisis in Malawi is comparing the number of doctors with the number of people in need of treatment. And I'm using here the figures from WHO for the 3x5. You see Brazil, the number of doctors, the ratio is about 1x1. Many countries are between 80 and 300-400, and Malawi is among the worst cases, with one doctor per 600 people in need for treatment. The situation in early 2004, when we started scaling up our program, we had a vast crisis, enormous needs, enormous willingness to scale up, $196 million from the Global Fund on the bank, not in Malawi, but on the bank, and basically no people to implement the program. When I started working in the Ministry of Health many people ask me, what are you going to do? This is a program that is not going to have, not going to be successful. The way, Went too far. We had some issues, and the many issues I can tell about our love-hate relation with the Global Fund. Without the Global Fund, we wouldn't have been scaling up as we have done so far. But we went through quite a few struggles. The human resources crisis was not new, did not suddenly come up when AIT became a possibility. It was being seen, having seen reports of early 90s that was forecasting the issues that were coming up. Nevertheless, through the Global Fund, we were not able to put anything in human resources, and our application was reduced. In 2004, our Secretary of Health publicly announced that the health sector in Malawi had collapsed. It was during a visit of Chakrabarty and Piot in February 2004, and both gentlemen on the visit to look at the scaling up of HIV/AIDS programs in Malawi saw there was no possibility to scaling up, no possibility to use the funds available. And Chakrabarty was speaking about requiring exceptional measures that might otherwise be dismissed as sustainable. Well, what was called in 2004 exceptional measures are now seen as mainstream. I mean, it's part of what the TTR approach of WHO. This led to the development of a six-year human resource emergency relief plan that costed out $270 million. And again, this was not new. The plans were there already, not for HIV/AIDS, but in general because of the severe crisis in Malawi. But it was never, was recognized, but never action had been taken. And here, what some people use is where HIV/AIDS is a wedge to improve human resources and health systems. We're looking at a bit of the funding of the program. Basically, Global Fund, DFID, and other donors in the sector-wide approach funded the program. 100 million through DFID, $40 million through a reprogramming of the first round of Global Funds, and $60 million through a round 5 grant. The other remaining quarter of the program through different donors in the sector-wide approach. This was a flexibility of the Global Fund. Basically, a U-turn was made. What was not possible in 2002 became possible in 2004. And I recommend the Global Fund for that. I mean, I said in these days many times before, a strengthened health system, including human resources for health, is critical for the success of HIV, TB, and malaria programs. And success of the HIV program depends on donors working together and supporting in Malawi the sector-wide approach. It's not one donor who can make it happen. And the question here is, how can the Global Fund become a part of the concerted efforts in Malawi? In the health sector, and if we're speaking about scaling up of AIT programs, we're speaking about the sector-wide approach. DFID is supporting. The Norwegian government is supporting, the World Bank is supporting, other donors are supporting this. At this moment, Global Fund is still, an odd case in the whole funding mechanisms. And there would be a lot of positive effects if Global Fund would become a partner of pooling and a partner of sector-wide approach. I understand that steps are underway, and we are waiting heavily for this. Apart from this success, the joint effort to work on the human resources problems in Malawi, I would like to take you a bit to the scaling up and universal access and of the AIT program in Malawi. Human resources are not being addressed. It can be addressed overnight, but the efforts and the results of the program will take a few years to come into action. At this moment, we had to develop a program, an AIT program, that is simple, standardized, inclusive, and making use of existing cadres in Malawi. The current status of the program, that we are in 120 sites, both in government, mission, and private sector, and 45,000 people on treatment and alive at this moment. If you're looking at this, we could not have done this without the Global Fund. And if you're looking at the future of the program, and with the current scaling up and the plans we have developed, and when I came to Malawi and working with my colleagues a couple of years, 3 years ago, we did not think what we think is possible today was possible at that moment. If we're scaling up at the pace we're scaling up at the moment, in 10 years' time, 5% of the adult population of Malawi will be on treatment. 300,000 people alive on treatment, probably needing somewhere around 2 million contacts with the health sector per year. An enormous need. We believe, and my colleagues in Malawi believe that it is possible to scale up to these numbers. But if you're looking what the costs are, we have some cost calculations, and we think that to have one person on treatment per year costs around $350. If we're scaling up to the numbers in our plans, it will add 60 to 100 million per year only for AAT to our budget. With a budget of $120 million a year, our health budget will increase by 60% in 2010 and by 80% in 2015. There are two questions here. One, we mentioned before, can the GA deliver? The Global Fund brought hope to millions of Malawians. At the time, we are ready to deliver. It's a question if we can really keep our promise. Our current Global Fund funding runs out in 2 years' time. And we know if we have to reapply for another grant for 5 years, we're probably speaking about $300 to $400 million that we would need for another 5 years for the HIV/AIDS program. At this moment, I think about $600 million was available for the whole round. Would Malawi use 50% of a new round? I have some doubts about it. Another issue is the sustainable financing schemes. I mean, without the Global Fund, the scaling up would not have been possible. But also the Global Fund monies have been proven very difficult to get. You maybe remember my first slide, $196 million on the bank. A big part of the money is still on the bank. Phase two, so years three, four, and five, started in October last year. And we are still waiting for money to get off to the bank, to help us to procure drugs, to help us to procure HIV test kits, to help us to implement the program. A part of the program has come to a halt right at this moment, and we are juggling to have enough supplies not to completely have the program stopped. Well, the Global Fund has proven to be flexible, and quite a few changes have been made over the last year. And I believe this flexibility is very much necessary in the coming years to help us to support the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Even though the closing words were a little bit critical, but I think that's part of why we're here. We want to listen, of course, to the challenges that the Global Fund as a system poses to you and poses to the recipients. And we hope that we will hear many more of critical questions in our discussion part of this session. But before that, let me please invite our next speaker, which is Alexei Bobrik. He is the principal recipient, an NGO recipient in Russia, scaling up a major program in ARV treatment. And it's remarkable, is leading a consortium of NGOs to do that, which I think is a unique situation in a area in the middle of Europe where actually an NGO culture didn't exist not too long ago. And he was certainly posed with many challenges and has been able to turn this into a great success, as he will present to us right now. Thank you, Alex.
Dear colleagues, it's a pleasure to be here with the presentation on the Global Fund activities in the Russian Federation. And first of all, a few words about the background. As most of you know, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, there has been several parallel epidemic of infectious disease in Russia, including rapid increase in TB and HIV rates. And at the same time, this deterioration of the epidemiological situation was happening while the country's own response was completely inadequate. In fact, the government denied HIV/AIDS epidemic. There was a severe underfunding of the whole health system and infectious control programs. And while there was not enough money, even the scarce resources were spent on ineffective intervention like mass screening and effective intervention like harm reduction, etc., were not included into governmental programs. Taking into account this situation, since the end of the 90s, there have been several international projects in Russia, which were quite important in building local capacity, and they were quite important in demonstrating what approaches can be successful in this environment. But in fact, they were unable to provide any significant impact on the situation, neither in terms of epidemiological impact nor in terms of changing the attitude of government. The turning point probably was the involvement of the Global Fund. And today, Global Fund has approved 5 grants to the Russian Federation within the 3rd, 4th, and 5th rounds. The figures are presented here. And it should be stressed that the Global Fund several times took brave decision to support non-CCM applications. 2 applications, non-CCM from NGOs, were supported in the 3rd round, and 1 application was supported in the 5th round. And in the area of HIV/AIDS, these 3 HIV/AIDS projects basically cover the whole spectrum of activities, starting from HIV prevention among general population to HIV prevention among vulnerable groups to provision of antiretroviral treatment, palliative care, and support to people living with HIV/AIDS. And at the moment, Global Fund is working in HIV/AIDS area in 19 regions of Russia, where about 35% of the population of the country's population live. And with every passing year, the number of the regions will increase. I hope that the following brief show will give you a better visual impression of what is going on with implementation of Global Fund activities in Russia. Here you can see the territories of Russia covered by the Global Fund activities in HIV/AIDS area. That's how we implement mass media campaigns and HIV prevention among youth and the general population. There are many programs in secondary schools, among policymakers, on TV. Harm reduction projects targeting injecting drug users and commercial sex workers, targeting prisoners. At the moment, more than 1,500 patients in Russia already receive antiretroviral medication within a framework of the Global Fund funding, and thousands will follow. So if we present some figures, the Global Fund activities in Russia already can be expressed in hundreds of seminars, in thousands of specialist training, in tens of thousands clients served. And if we are talking, for example, about coverage by mass media campaigns, we are talking about millions of people. So in a nutshell, the key achievements of the Global Fund can be summarized as improved access to quality prevention and treatment services and strengthening of civil society, because only with the involvement of the Global Fund, civil society could really play a significant role in the implementation of HIV/AIDS control activities and could get the respect of the government. But probably even more important was the stimulation of effective national response to HIV/AIDS in Russia. Because after the Global Fund came, first of all, the government realized that the problem exists, And then what is even more important, successful model was demonstrated. So in 2006, the financial commitment of the government rose 20-fold, and in the next year it will be double. At the moment, intervention with just a year ago, we were quite sensitive and controversial in the Russian environment, like harm reduction. These interventions are included into a federal program, and NGOs participate in the implementation of the governmental programs. So basically, we are living in a completely different country if we compare it with respect to HIV/AIDS to what it was just 2 years ago. And such a drastic transformation became possible because the Global Fund intervened just 2 years ago. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexei. We're coming to our last presentation, formal presentation, before we come to the round of discussions with questions. And I don't think the program, the AIDS program of Thailand, needs any further introduction. It has been one of the first huge successes. And our colleague, Dr. Thavisab, has been involved quite prominently in setting this up. And he's today presenting further work that has been implemented with support of the Global Fund. Please.
Thank you, Werner. Ladies and gentlemen, I am honored to be with you today, particularly sitting among the panelists who are diving the antiretroviral treatment to be the reality in the developing countries. My presentation today will outline the issue raised for the discussion for achieving universal access. In addition, some experiences in Thailand will be briefly described how we achieve universal access to ART within 4 years after the initiation of the expansion program. Okay. When we talk about universal access to prevention and care, there is no doubt on the benefit of this effort. They can save millions of lives if we can implement in a timely manner. In Thailand, if there is no HIV intervention in the early 90s, 7.1 million will be infected with HIV. 6.4 million can be saved from the collective activity or prevention program. This slide shows the number of annual deaths which we can prevent from the national program, which we started in the early 2002. There are more than 100,000 lives can be saved. However, the benefit is very evident on the first 5 years. After 10 years, the benefit will be decreasing due to this model is not include the second line treatment for those who develop resistance. What we have learned from 3x5 strategy, even we miss the target, but we can increase the number of people on ART dramatically. 1 million of lives can be saved. And Thailand is one among some countries who can meet the target. And we can announce the universal coverage on October 1st, 2005. Can we do the same for the rest of the world by 2010? The answer is yes, but we need a concerted effort with a sustained manner. The four common issues for successful scaling up program are ARV and other commodities affordability. The second is human and infrastructure capacity. The third pillar are multi-sector and level collaboration. And lastly, resource mobilization and sustainable financing. However, there are other challenges for the program implementation. At what level of ART coverage is feasible for limited resource country? How are you facing to the universal access? And what approach and strategy will be used to achieve the appropriate quality? You have to ensure the equity between the rural, gender, and also the marginalized population? And how about the long-term sustainability? This slide shows the number of people who are on ARV since the year 2001. At that moment, we have about 3,000 people on ARV. The breakthrough happened in the year 2002 when the government pharmaceutical organization is able to produce the local generic drug with the cost of $30 a month. At that moment, we start to expand the ARV program and launched the national program in the year 2002. Global Fund has the major contribution and has come in the right time in the year 2003. The number of people receiving ARV expand to 58,000 and reached the universal access in the year 2005. The second point that I would like to raise is that when we're talking about the scaling up program, the site that we are expanding have to be covered to the general, to the community hospital. At the beginning of the program, we have to ensure that every province in the in Thailand have the access, have the ability to provide ART treatment, both adult and children. And by the year 2004, all district hospitals are able to provide ART. When we're talking about the ARV affordability, the cost of ARV in the year 2001 is 220. In April 2002, government pharmaceutical organization launched the fixed dose combination with the cost of $30. Global Fund has contributed a lot of budget to by this ARV and providing 30% of ARV to this patient in Thailand. However, we are not able to afford the second line treatment because the cost is quite high and we are not able to produce locally. The situation is even worse. Since April 2005, Thailand is not able to use the Global Fund budget to purchase GPO generic product due to the policy restriction of WHO GMP pre-qualification. The price of our first line ARV from original company are 3 to 10 times, even they had been market more than 15 years. And the drug that we used to treat 100,000 people for 2 years is not able to buy using the Global Fund money. There is no practical mechanism to for lower middle income country to get the global access flight from the original companies. The question is, do we compromise the quality of care in our country if the GPO is not able to meet the WHO GMP pre-qualification? The other good thing for the Global Fund is, Global Fund has a lot of contribution in the laboratory infrastructure. Before the year 2002, the cost of ARV is about $25, and we have only 18 units located only in 14 provinces to provide service for 3,000 patients. Currently, the cost of CD4 reduced to $6, and we have 90 units for monitoring the immunological status for more than 100,000 cases. The contribution from Global Fund is more evidence for multi-sector and multi-level collaboration, particularly among civil society. Global Fund budget is able to support and strengthen people living with HIV network to work as equal partner and is not the target population. We provide resources for them to create the holistic center, working with the community hospital to provide counseling, home-based care, and adherent counseling. 20,000 of people living with HIV receiving service from 160 holistic centers. within 2 years. The target will be reached 300 centers out of 800 hospitals around the country, and we expect 40,000 people living with HIV to receive that service. Global Fund also supports the faith-based organization to provide community and home-based care. This is the first time that four religions, including Buddhism, Muslim, Protestant, and Catholic, has jointly created an interfaith network for providing HIV care, and 4,500 people living with HIV are expected to receive this benefit. Regarding to resource mobilization, the government of Thailand has increased the budget from $6.2 million in 2002 to $70 million and able to integrate into the universal health coverage, which is cover 48 million out of 65 million population in the year 2006. The social security scheme, which covers 8 million workers in private sector, has agreed to provide health benefits, including ART, in the year 2004. The Global Fund contribution has decreased. We are able to integrate the resource mobilization and use the Global Fund decreased from 40% into 50% in the year 2006. However, if we are considering the second line treatment, this model shows the cost of public ART on the first line for asymptomatic and symptomatic people in Thailand in the year until the year 2025. The red bar shows that 70% of the cost to cover universal access is caused from the second line treatment using the current price that we are procuring. Can we achieve the goal of universal access to treatment by the year 2010? And this we have to ensure that we can provide the appropriate quality and be able to sustain. Our efforts has never been end in Thailand, even we are able to integrate into the universal coverage, but there are still many marginalized population, minorities, and which is not Thai citizen, which is not able to entitled to the Thai law. So the universal access is not mean only people living in your country, but all over the world. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Tavisa. I think we couldn't have a better handover to the discussion part. Yes, absolutely. I think together we can. That's why here we have two microphones in the room in those two aisles, and would like you to actually stand behind those microphones. And while you line up with your questions, I will take them one by one. I would like to kick off. We have actually three new people on the podium. We have Dr. Andrew Ball, who is a senior strategy and operations advisor in the HIV department of the World Health Organization. We have Kate Hankins, who is associate director, and I'm sure I get this wrong because it has changed, for policy evidence and partnerships in UNAIDS, and has been with there for a long time. And we have a colleague from Paul Farmer's program, Dr. Kruf. It's a great pleasure that he could come here. And if you allow me, I would suggest that we actually go straight into the questions, and please also address those questions to our colleagues who have joined the table in WHO and from UNAIDS. Why don't I take the first question here, microphone one.
Hi, I'm Valeria from Mexico, and I just wanted to join to the comment on our colleague from Thailand. Mexico is in the same situation. We also want to be reconsidered to can access to the fund of the Global Fund, because every year we spend $5,000 per patient in RFP, and we won't be able to continue giving treatment. I'm not in the health sector, But I'm a concerned citizen because I know what's going to happen. That's it. And the question is, could you help us? Are we going to have an answer on this? Thank you.
Could you? I didn't quite get the question.
Mexico, asylum, we are paying $5,000 per year per person because of the intellectual property, because we cannot produce the medications in our country. So we pay the full price, $5,000 per year. Yes. And as you know, our countries are not that rich. We have rich people, but not rich government. So, yeah. I understand that we have to engage them, and we are trying, but in the meanwhile, people is going to die. So, can we have an answer on that? Thank you.
That's a difficult start to discuss intellectual property rights. Andrew, I'm not sure, or Kate, would you be in a position to talk to that? the Global Fund is obviously not in a position and doesn't work in a way that we actually prescribe which interventions are being used in the countries. We have clearly the policy that the cheapest and most effective commodities should be used, but we are not in a position to actually enter into a discussion on legal requirements and possibilities, including, for example, trade agreements. Now, there are many ways which one can use to actually overcome those, but we are not in a position to impose those on the countries because that has to be driven from the country level. We certainly do pay for generic drugs in many, many countries, in majority of countries, at much cheaper prices, but we are not in a good position to actually impose legal registrations that are simply outside of our mandate.
Thank you, I understand, and I won't take more time. Just, I think, when we speak about universal access, this is going to be a major problem.
Yes, it is indeed, and that is why I had hoped that our colleague from UNAIDS would be able to comment on that.
I will comment to the extent that we see this as a major issue, and UNDP in particular is trying to work with countries, as we are, to use the flexibilities that are there in TRIPS when they're negotiating their free trade agreements. But it's not an easy task at all, and I think it has to be addressed at a much higher level if we're going to get action on this. I agree with you completely.
Unfortunately, we haven't been very helpful for this first question, but I hope we can do better with the second question.
Me too. I'd first like to thank you for your work and thank you for taking the time with this presentation. My name is Damian Salomon. I'm from the United States. My question is relating to health system investment, and I was very happy to hear Daniel talk about the importance of sustainable health system investment. And so a concern that I have, though, is how broadly we define the term health system. So as we heard from Paul Farmer earlier, he received a grant for HIV/AIDS work, and he horizontalized that in order to support the infrastructure of the country. And so in particular, my experience is in East Africa. And so my question is, in a country where you have virtually no public infrastructure, that is to say, poor roads, poor telephone services, no access to clean water, and no power, does the Global Fund have a plan, and does the Global Fund issue and provide grants for road building and for electricity and for these other what seem to be peripheral needs, but in fact it's what the health systems rest upon?
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a very good question, and we certainly emphasized it in the Global Fund presentation. I think also the Minister from Ethiopia, who has a country health system strengthening plan into which our resources can go. At the same time, the focus of the Global Fund is on increasing the access and the delivery of services for AIDS, TB, and malaria. So a grant always has to show that it can increase the access, the quality of services to these people. I would also like to say that we certainly aren't the answers to all the problems in the health systems in the country. So while we can do our part, and I think our funds have been shown to be flexible, from Rwanda to Ethiopia to the other examples we've seen, even in Thailand, it does rely on other partners as well to come up with the health systems plans to complement our funding so that this can be used both to deliver services and to strengthen the systems through which they are delivered.
I think our colleague from Ethiopia may want to comment on that as well briefly.
Yeah, thank you very much. When I said, when I started my speech, I said Global Fund is really flexible. And one example is actually from the funds we have discussed with the Global Fund and we're able to reprogram to strengthen the health system. So we're upgrading 500 clinics to become health centers. And when we upgrade them, it means there will be two blocks for ART clinic, VCT, and PMTCT. But this will not be just used for ART, PMTCT, and VCT. The VCT will be a general lab that can be used for other issues, for lab services. And PMTCT will be used for MCH delivery, normal deliveries even. And the ART clinic can be used as OPD. By the way, one of the things I would like to say here is it's the health system which is increasing stigma and discrimination, because in our health facilities, we really label the services, the units or sections for HIV AIDS, as, ART clinic or something. Then people tend to be scared because we treat them as special. So even with this new funding, which was reprogrammed, what we're trying to do is to really abandon that. And, any person with HIV can be treated like any other person. So when he's going to an OPD, nobody knows that he's actually positive. So we are trying to abandon that and, provide the services openly to everybody. So not only that, but it's helping, whatever funding we're getting from Global Fund to do for, the ART services is being used for other services, as I said. So PMTCT should be part of the MCH, and that's why I said it's flexible. And for the long term, it's one of the sustainability issues is to increase the capacity of the health services, because you cannot really have a huge vertical program like HIV/AIDS in a weak health system. And we have to increase the carrying capacity of the health system in order to carry the specific, or heavy programs like malaria, HIV, TB, and reproductive health or other specific vertical programs. Thank you.
Eric, very short comment?
Yes, very short. We're working towards universal access, but I don't think there's a universal donor. And but often in day-to-day business in the Ministry of Health in Malawi, we know every donor has got its constraints. And some donors are good in A, use this donor. Some donors are good in B, use this donor. Sometimes, whatever. And of course, we ask for more flexibility, and we need more flexibility of donors. And that is a good way, but no donor will complete flexibility. And I believe what we're looking at, if you speak about a concerted effort, if you're looking at what's happening in many countries, and also in Malawi, is a sector-wide approach, where donors come together, and together they're agreeing on a plan together with government. At that moment, by donors working together, you're getting donors buying into a joint plan. And that is what we want to go forward. Not having one donor being completely flexible. I don't think it will ever happen.
Okay. Thank you.
I would like to go in. I think microphone one.
Hi, my name is Julia, and I'm from the Student Global AIDS Campaign in the United States. And I had a specific question also for Daniel Lobier, but really any of the panelists. But my question is, you talked about the challenges that the Global Fund is currently facing, and especially the investment conditions for health that you mentioned. And I was wondering if you could expand more, not just the challenges that you mentioned, but more specifically some solutions that you might have in mind, or any of the other panelists. Some innovative solutions. We hear a lot about the challenges, but I'm interested in your ideas for real concrete social change. So thanks.
Okay, that's another ambitious question for me to answer to. but thank you very much. First of all, we're a partnership system, so we don't implement our programs directly. We rely on partners, we rely on donors to finance. And the challenge I put forward were for us, but also to our partners, WHO, UNAIDS, so that we can support programs to work closely together and of course, to donors. The investment conditions for health were really referring to Richard's point around education, of making health as attractive for long-term 10 billion, 15 billion commitments over 10 years. And this certainly goes beyond the Global Fund. In countries where there are transparent, costed plans, as we heard from Malawi and Ethiopia, this certainly builds the confidence of donors to fund in them. But there's a lot of countries where we don't have this, where we have stronger health systems which can account for money, can ensure the quality of services as they scale up. This also improves the confidence of the investment conditions in health. I don't think I can go into all the solutions here, but it was trying to put the challenge collectively that we need to work alongside WHO, alongside the World Bank, to ensure that instead of some of the divisions that occur, we improve the investment conditions in health. Development plans, they're linked to these costed plans and the confidence of donors. And I think we've got a challenge and quite a step forward to go in health to be able to do that.
Thank you. I suggest we if you agree, I see a lot of interest, there's a lot of questions, a lot of people in the room, we would suggest we actually run 10 minutes over. We have been a little bit delayed in the presentations because they've been so exciting. So we allow a few more questions and we'll try to make sure that we have very short answers to get as many as possible. We are back to microphone two.
Thank you. My name is Jackson Bogela. I come from Tanzania. My question will be directed to the Minister for Health from Ethiopia. As we have heard that the Global Fund is performance-related funds, and there is a feeling from the civil society that there is corruption with a lot of money directed on HIV and AIDS, especially to low-developed countries. And the minister had made a comment that the evaluations of Global Fund funds based on performance-related has given a lesson to Ethiopia, and therefore that's why they have achieved. Now my question is, do you think there will be changes in number of countries, because there are some countries which are even scared to apply for the Global Fund now, and while the problem is still big in those countries, especially low-developed countries and the African countries, what should we expect? Will there be some changes? Will be proper investments and proper allocations of these funds?
We're not quite clear what the question is to the minister. Could you try to reformulate that?
Okay. My question is, there have been a feeling from the civic society in low-developed countries that money have been embezzled, or there are some sort of corruptions and fraud for money allocated on HIV and AIDS activities. So I'm asking the minister, what should we expect in the future so that we should reach access, a universal access? What should we expect? Is this feeling true? And if it is true, what should we expect? If there are going to be changes or not? Am I clear now?
I think in our country, there is zero tolerance to corruption, and there is already an institution that follows that. And I assure you that there may be some petty problems, but I don't consider corruption as a big problem in Ethiopia. And we have the system, actually. And we have to be very, strict on that. And we have to continue to be very vigilant. Because this support which is coming is really unprecedented. And there is a huge support from Global Fund. There is a huge support from PEPFAR. And we shouldn't really fail our partners. And this money is meant for our poor people. And our government is really committed to use it wisely. And I can tell you some of the things we're doing, actually. For instance, most of the money is used for procurement. And we have already requested the Global Fund, and we're doing it, actually, to really make direct payment with our procurement agent. We're using UNICEF as procurement agent, so we don't even see the money. Recently, we have ordered 6.3 million bed nets, and $34 million was directly paid from Global Fund to our procurement agent, to UNICEF. Because I think the communities need the bloody bed nets or the bloody drugs. We don't need to have the money actually and even do the procurement. It can speed up if the money can be transferred directly from the donors to the supplier, and then commodities can be used, you know, can reach the communities actually as fast as possible. By the way, this mechanism can also, address the corruption issue, because the corruption is country level. And if the commodities can come by, you know, not only it increases the speed, but also it can address that one. So this was based on our needs, and any country can join. And the huge targets we have now for Global Fund and, for HIV and malaria, we are achieving them because we're using this kind of arrangement. But any government should have really zero tolerance for corruption, because it's a disease, actually, and which is really irresponsible. Thank you.
Thank you. I suggest that we take a few questions now at one time and distribute it to the different panelists. Microphone one, please.
My name is Marcelo Venegas Pizarro. I'm a HIV doctor who works in New York. And my comment is a comment question, but it's a humble appeal from my experience from micro, looking at from micro to macro. I work in New York City in one of the largest aid service organizations in the United States. And I think it's clear from this conference and from previous conferences, and I think it's evidence-based to say that HIV/AIDS is an issue of poverty. And I don't think it would be very myopic to combat that and say that it's not. Just like other infectious diseases, HIV is an issue of poverty. In micro, in New York City, in areas where there's most poverty, you see the most concentration in the neighborhoods, you see the most concentration of HIV. The same applies to the world. And what we've seen, where I work in Housing Works, is the name of my organization, when we provide housing for people, miraculously people with HIV get better and take their meds when we provide affordable housing. Which we have done through our organization. When we provide mental health and substance abuse treatment, miraculously people start taking their meds and they get better. So the appeal is, looking at it in the micro level, is also looking at it in the macro level, with what Paul Farmer previously stated, is maybe opening your horizons just a little bit, and maybe being both evidence-based and also cost-effective, in that maybe your mandate is not to deal with TRIPS agreements, but if you're talking about, like the Minister of Health from Thailand well said, the difference between $30 and $500, it's almost intuitive that if you do not and you continue, you've only treated, and I hate to be, you know, so drastic, but you only treated on your ARV treatment 500,000 people. The person from Malawi told us that,
could you try to, because we have
a couple of questions. I'm trying to get to my point.
Question, yes.
Yeah, sure. Okay,
please, thank you.
6 people die per minute. In the last 2 hours, 120 people have died. 3 million people who died in the last year, 5 million people newly infected, and yet you've only treated 500,000. And so my question is, if you, in a 3.5 years, which is the time left till 2010, you plan to have universal access to all, which is considered maybe like a joke, my question is, if you do not become cost-effective, if you do not, in your annual report, you have a picture of Kalitra, and I ask myself, people in Africa do not get Kalitra. So my question is, why not deal with the issue of trips, number one? Why not open up, as Paul Farmer has suggested, to not just the issue of treatment or the issue of HIV/AIDS, but the issue of poverty in general? And taking that stance, maybe you will become much more effective as an organization. And I think you need to do that at this point.
Okay, thank you. I have microphone two. We collect a few questions and then go through the panelists.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief. My name is Odilon Cousin. I work for an organization called China AIDS Info in Beijing. I think we all know that universal access will require a huge scale-up of ARV treatment, both first and second line. And the cost of that is going to be daunting no matter who pays the bill. China currently produces a lot of the raw materials for generics, export to India, export to Brazil. Even the multinationals buy a lot of the raw materials in China. Can the international agencies at the podium, like UNAIDS, WHO, the Global Fund, call on China to take its place in the world and challenge the WTO rules and the U.S. trade representative and actually produce second line especially, because I think they have the capacity. But they need the support of the internationals. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Please, microphone one.
You know, just 1 minute, maybe. I am from Argentina. I belong to the CCM, which is organizing the Global Fund grant. We're very happy in our poorest time. In 2002, we obtained a grant from the Global Fund. And we have organized our prevention much better than we have done until now because of the pressure of the church. You know, the pressure of the Catholic Church is very important in Argentina. Our government gives free treatment to all of the infected people who haven't got insurance. I don't know for how long it's going to be able to keep it, because we know that at least 3/4 of the infected people, we haven't reached them. So, you know, our government spends all the money in treatment, really, in ARV treatment, and it's very important that it's so. But then we need money for prevention, and that is my plea, really. But now we are not able to apply because we are a low-middle-income country. So I am praying to you, I am asking you, please, that we are able to continue with this program, which is so beneficial for us, which is going to diminish the infections. Yes.
Thank you. I take the question from microphone two.
Thank you. My name is Peli Nalatikau. I'm from Fiji. I'm also the UNAIDS representative, special representative for the Pacific. Now, excluding Australia and New Zealand, of the other 22 Pacific Island countries and territories, only three, Niue, Pitcairn, and Tokelau, are free of HIV/AIDS. However, the majority of the other 19 countries are almost close to, as Dr. Peter Peart said, the tipping point, that ominous point which varies between countries, after which AIDS no longer remains concentrated in so-called hotspots, but becomes a generalized explosion across the entire country. Last year, the decision was taken by the Global Fund not to provide additional support to the Pacific, which has a total population of 8.6 million, with a cumulative total of 12,169 positive cases, giving a World Health Organization figure of 121,690. Will the Global Fund reconsider its decision?
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let me take very quickly the last one, two questions, very brief, please.
I'll try to be brief. My name is Intra Collins from Thailand. Very lucky to say that we're a subrecipient of yours. We're running an ARV treatment program at the moment in our third year. I'd like to make two requests to the Global Fund representatives. The first is, I don't know if you're already thinking or doing this, but I'd like to request for the Global Fund to be more involved in ensuring that all Global Fund funded programs get global access pricing for all ARV drugs. Because at the moment, for the past 3 years, we've been trying to negotiate on an individual basis with all sorts of pharmaceutical companies for global access pricing, which is theoretically available for all Global Fund funded programs. But because we're in Thailand and not in Africa, this does not apply to us. And to date, we've only secured global access pricing from one drug, which is from Gilead. All of the rest have flat denied us. And I know the Global Fund is often said to be just a financial entity, but I'd like to stress that you're a very, very powerful financial entity. And for our relatively small program, we have very small negotiation power. But for you, I'd really like to request your assistance on that. And the second, I'd like to support Dr. Tawisap's call for the Global Fund's flexibility in Thailand's case to continue purchase of GPO-produced generic drugs while it's in the process of obtaining WHO pre-qualification, because the last thing we want to do is use your very valuable funds to pay 10 times the price for a drug which we would rather buy generically. And we have a lot of data on its safety and efficacy, and especially in our program from PHPT, we're more than happy to provide them. Thank you.
Let me talk the very last question, very brief, please, because we have to close the session. Okay, no.
My name is Mario Burgos of Argentina.
Okay, why don't we take that question offline, because I think we have to move on. It's translating for me. Okay, please, then go ahead.
So if I'm understanding well, that your job is to get more funding for the Global Fund. Our job is to do the work better in our countries to control the epidemic. For in your part, you have to interview potential donors. And what we have to do is to understand what other organizations in the world are doing. We were expecting that the Global Fund would allow to have meetings where they would be translated in terms of understanding what the other organizations, what other countries are doing globally.
No hacer eso no solo impide el enriquecimiento de nuestras actividades.
By not doing that, we are not able to really enrich in the activities that we do in our countries. And we're not learning how to also be able to lobby or ask so that our government or our company or our private sector can give us new funding.
Could you try to come to a concrete question or point you want to make? Because
I don't want to make a question. You have to listen to me, please.
La pregunta es si van a garantizar antes que termine la conferencia otra reunión donde podamos colectivizar nuestras experiencias y ellos las escuchen.
The question is, are you going to have another meeting? Is the Global Fund going to have another meeting where we can collectivize our experiences and learn from each other.
Thank you very much.
Translated also to Spanish.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I see three questions that deal with drug licensing issues, the TRIP, the trade agreements, which are, of course, very tricky issues, that global fund policies are very clear in that we are not prescribing anything, but we do require to use the best possible drugs and the cheapest drugs. It's very clear, but it's none of our business to actually interfere with international trade agreements. That is not our competitive advantage. However, I would like to refer very briefly to our colleagues from UNAIDS, maybe to summarize some of the issues that have been raised from your point of view and potentially also from the World Health Organization related to the drug licensing issues. Is it?
Maybe because I've already spoken, Andrew might want to talk a bit about the pre-qualification issues.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I'm not the best person to talk about this issue, but certainly we're aware of the critical issue around pricing, and we're having to look at various strategies, not only for price reduction, but also looking at sustainable financing within countries through such schemes as domestic insurance schemes. Certainly one of the significant bottlenecks that has been identified, and we hear about the Thailand cases, is that of the time it takes for pre-qualification and to address that. I'm very pleased to say that we have a significant grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to dramatically scale up our capacity for pre-qualification so that we can actually move the various candidates' products through the system so that they can be pre-qualified as quickly as possible and be made available through Global Fund funds. That also includes not only HIV medicines, but also HIV diagnostics.
Okay, thank you. There was another question, I think, about eligibility criteria for the Global Fund and target setting that came up in the broader discussion. And Kate would very briefly be able to answer that.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that in terms of eligibility, there has been an attempt to look at burden of disease and look at capacity of countries to finance their own responses in deciding which countries can get access to funding. And it's something that you can look on the website and get a better idea about. But I did want to say something about target setting, because this universal access process started a year ago with the G8. It then led to the General Assembly instructing UNAIDS Secretariat and the co-sponsors to work with countries to help establish a roadmap and costed plans for universal access. And this autumn is very important because countries are going to be trying to set their targets. We're wanting them to set ambitious targets as opposed to there being some global target thrown out that then people have to figure out how they meet. So they're having to go through the process of determining what for them is universal access, how ambitious should they be in a funding context which is unclear. We heard it from Stephen Lewis before. Looking at the Global Fund, that's one part of it, but looking at from a country's perspective at all the different sources of funding that are available, how can we ask them to set ambitious targets when it's not clear what funding is going to be available and how sustainable it's going to be? I thought Agnes Minowaha was very articulate on that this morning. You know, we're stumbling along, as Stephen Lewis was saying, trying to find the $500 million for 2006, at a time when we're asking countries to be ambitious in their target setting. And I really think we've got to do something about the funding situation and rapidly.
Okay. Thank you. We have one open question. We have actually two open questions. One I would like Christoph to answer in his closing, which relates to the meetings. We actually do have meetings, regular meetings of the Global Fund, which he may be able to address as the responsible person in the Global Fund. There was one other question, Argentina, which related to the tension between prevention and treatment. I suggest that because we have to close the session, that we may take this offline. It is certainly an extremely important issue, and we encourage, of course, it needs to be country-driven. The Global Fund can't determine, will not determine what countries should be doing, because that is against our principle. But what can we do to actually make sure in a partnership
in a global partnership that prevention doesn't fall off the crack is certainly very, very important discussion, and we have heard this throughout this conference very prominently and loudly. But with that, I would like to ask Christoph Benn to actually say a few closing remarks, summarizing, and maybe also if you can answer that one question regarding the meetings to exchange experiences for the Global Fund programs between countries and recipients. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Bernard, and I will definitely not take much more of your time. I'm looking into many tired faces. So just to say also thank you very much to all the panelists who have responded to our invitation. I think it was a very, very interesting and inspiring discussion. To that particular question on Global Fund meetings, yes, the Global Fund is inviting to many, many meetings. We just concluded our partnership forum in Durban, but also particularly because you asked the question in Spanish, we have been running an e-forum, an electronic discussion forum, where people from around the world could comment on the Global Fund model and make suggestions, recommendations, also strategic recommendations in four languages, in English, French, Russian, and Spanish. And you can go to our website. There's a Spanish site as well. And we encourage people to participate. We organize regional meetings as well. And we provided lots of meetings also during this conference for this kind of open exchange, because the Global Fund really wants to be a learning and listening organization. And I think also, I mean, glad, although the session was running late, that we had this opportunity to listen to you and your concerns and your suggestions. So I'm closing the session maybe just with one thought. I thought there was tremendous hope listening to the various examples from countries and seeing the diverse situations from Thailand and Russia and Malawi and Ethiopia, and you could see, and Haiti, and you could see that real progress has been made and access to prevention, care, and treatment is possible. But we also, I think, sense the deep concern, triggered certainly by Stephen Lewis, but also many other suggestions and contributions. Is this sustainable? And it would be an absolute disaster, as Kate also just said, if we would stop kind of halfway. And there is a real risk that, I mean, we engaged in this very audacious journey towards universal access, particularly on treatment. But what would happen if we would say in a year or so, we can only maintain and we cannot really put more people on treatment? That would absolutely be a disaster. It would not only be a broken promise by the G8 and others, but it would also cause millions of unnecessary lives. And we cannot even contemplate this thought. I think we have to continue together to make sure that we have the resources so that we reach universal access. Anything else is unthinkable. And leaving just with one thing, normally I talk about the big amounts that the Global Fund needs, the hundreds of millions and the billions of money. I would just like to alert you to one little campaign that we started here in Toronto, which is called Hope Spreads Faster Than AIDS. And it is a good message, I think, also to close this session, because it's very much also about hope. We know that AIDS spreads, but we also know that hope spreads. And we have to make sure that hope spreads faster than AIDS. And we've launched a campaign that everybody can engage in. We can appeal to the G8 leaders and to the rich persons of the world, and we are grateful to Bill and Melinda Gates for their generous contribution, but we also need to engage citizens of the world in this campaign to mobilize resources, raise awareness, and this offers the opportunity to please, many of you, or probably all of you, have seen these pictures because you have all the floor mats wherever you go in the building, and many might wonder, what is that? Hope spreads faster than AIDS. That is a campaign that we've launched with many different partners. And you can click on the website, you can order stamps, and you can use them at the moment in the US, but later on in other countries, and also in other countries, NGOs, partners, organizations can use metered mail, and part of the proceeds will go to the Global Fund and will contribute in a small way to the financing of what we've discussed this evening for universal access. So it's a matter for those who have the money and the power, but it's also a matter for each and one of us, and I hope you will contribute to that. Thank you very much, and thank you for contributing.